Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and welcome to our podcast series. Believe it or not, we have never interviewed a label in all these years. This is our 10th year. Podcast isn't 10 years old, but we've been around a while. We've just never interviewed a label. And there's a first time for everything, and I'm really glad that this label is the one we're going to start the label conversation with. They're producing great stuff, very interesting story. They have a unique approach to music and presenting it, and I asked the CEO, Louis Marks, if he'd be interested in talking with us. He said, yeah, and so here he is. So welcome, Louis.
Hey, Ken. How are you?
Good, thank you. And yourself?
I'm good.
Good. What put you on my map, on my radar, was the Eddie Palmieri album, Wisdom. Actually, it's not just Wisdom. There's another word in there.
Sabiduria, pardon my bad Spanish, yeah.
Yeah, and mine's not that much better, but it's a great, I don't know what sabiduria means, maybe it means wisdom.
It does, yes.
Oh, it does, okay, good, I've learned a new Spanish word. But what a good title for this, because, you know, Eddie, this was put out in 17, I don't know how old Eddie was when he recorded it, but he's 80 now, and he certainly has accumulated a mountain of musical wisdom, which he displays all the time. He's one of the great forces of nature in the musical world right now. And anybody who likes Latin jazz, I mean, you just got to buy it. Just get it. There's nothing to think about. You've got to own it. But even if you're a jazz, just a so-called pure or mainstream jazz person, especially if you love piano, this is an essential album. How did you come to work with Eddie on this?
Well, it's interesting. Many things happen over here through connection, as they do in a lot of places. Christian Scott, Atunde Ajua, had released a couple records with us, and there's some crossover in his band with Mr. Palmieri's band. And so they're in their conversation. I think they were also working on a music app for education together. And so they Christian connected the Palmieri family with us. And
started
discussions towards the release of that record and some more things to come as well.
And speaking of jazz, because we are a jazz website, talk about some of the other jazz artists that are on your label that you've worked with over the years.
Oh, my.
Just the names. There's a lot. You might leave somebody out, and you know, I'm kind of throwing this at you out of the blue, but just names people might recognize.
Gotcha. I'm going to walk over to our wall of fame here to help with that. You know, the label's been here for 18 years. So, you know, early days, people like John Medeski, who was the founder of Rope-A-Dope, and Charlie Hunter in early days, and then moving, you know, into more current times, Snarky Puppy, Nate Smith, Christian Scott, I mentioned, Spanky McCurdy, Terrace Martin, Dred Scott, Frank Catalano, and I know I'm missing a bunch. It just goes on and on. There are quite a few, Nate Smith that I mentioned, quite a few jazz players come to Rope-A-Dope for their debut or their solo careers. So there are a lot of those as well. Richard Bennett. Go on.
And you mentioned Charlie Hunter, the guitar player.
Correct. Yeah, Charlie was on Blue Note for a while and then went independent in the early 2000s. So there are, I think, three or four Charlie Hunter records during his Rope-A-Dope time. Then he returned last year with an interesting record with Dion Farris, which is a vocal and guitar record of Dionne Warwick's songs.
Oh, cool. Cool. And, of course, we're talking about Rope-A-Dope records. And, the thing that caught me was this album with Eddie Palmieri. Any stories, backstories about this album? I mean, I understand that you met, the opportunity came up through connections within the label. I've seen Eddie Palmieri perform many, many times, most recently at Blue Note. I guess last summer he did a series for to commemorate or honor or note his 80th birthday, and yeah. It was just stunning. It was just absolutely stunning. And I had a friend who had come up from Cuba. He was stunned because, you know, this was an evening they devoted to traditional son music, and he was just amazed. He didn't expect it to hear this kind of level of Latin music in New York City. It's a right. new thing for him coming out of Cuba. And so, anything you want to share about this particular album, other than the fact that it really is essential listening?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. You know, I learned a lot in this process. You know, one of the first things that happens here is the relationship. And so, you know, obviously we were, you know, incredibly honored to be talking with Mr. Palmieri and his family. And, you know, there's an independent spirit that he has and a spirit of creativity and crossover that is evident in all the early conversations and discussions about, you know, how they do business and what their intent is. And, you know, and it's a little wild and progressive and creative. And, you know, it's not something you'd automatically think of someone that's, you know, in their eighth decade. But, you know, that's the first thing that hit us. And, of course, you know, little stories about, you know, how Harlem River Drive was made and, you know, what their intent was with this new record and, you know, the new territory that they wanted to push into. You know, all of those things were very comfortable right out of the gate. Because we're talking about the way that we do business and what our intent is, and, you know, and it turns out, you know, to be, and the terms over years, but fiercely independent, you know, mm-hmm. is the thing that came across. And then, of course, we got to hear the music. And I think part of it simply was Mr. Palmieri is accustomed to someone saying that doesn't quite fit here or that doesn't quite fit there, because he's always pushing in, you know, in different directions. And for us, it was like that fits perfectly here. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's interesting. Forward. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because when I was listening to it, I thought, wow, this is Eddie Palmieri unchained. Like, he is mm-hmm. going everywhere. It felt like he was going everywhere he wanted to go. And, you know, in the music business, as you know, that doesn't happen every time on a project. What was his intention? Can you share any of that about what he had in mind for this particular, what his goal was and what he wanted to communicate with it?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of reflection of, you know, how did this happen? You look back and you're like, how is there Latin jazz and R&B and soul and funk all blended together? And of course, Harlem River Drive is a key piece in that from back in the day. So I think mm-hmm. in a certain way he wanted to revisit that a little bit, but the spirit of that, he also wanted to, you know, express, I'm sorry, the word is dedicate the album to his wife who had passed recently, and really, you know, put out a comprehensive piece that sort of, you know, covered the spirit of what he had done, but keep it fresh and relevant to today. So, you know, you'll see the old cats on the record, and then you'll see young, you know, what they call the young guns mm-hmm. in the band, like Louis Fouché. So, you know, that's intent was so relevant. I mean, I like to listen to this record and imagine that it was just a brand new band doing something
yeah.
fresh, and you're like, you can believe that, except at a moment you're going to say, well, wait a minute, they really know how to play. They can't be 21-year-olds, you know, but it feels like that. You could place it there and say, well, you know, if you took the title off, you would get the impression that somebody was just, you know, young, on fire and trying brand new things.
You know, that's, you know, exactly right. You know, sometimes when I listen to music, I can't necessarily articulate why I like it so much. But besides the fact of this unbounded quality, because he goes in all kinds of different directions from track to track. But yeah, it had this vitality, this, you know, this wasn't phoned in, you know, this wasn't, mm-hmm. Hey, we need to do a record. We got a contract to fulfill. Let's crank something out. This was on fire.
Yeah, and it also feels like it wasn't, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead.
It feels like, you know, that it wasn't made for a performance hall or a recital hall, you know, like
right.
this could be out at an old ballroom with people dancing, you know.
Yep. So I'm going to just read a couple of the titles. Now, the titles don't say, you know, you can't tell until you hear the music. But Wise Bada Blues, Bata. You got it. That's phenomenal. I also love this title, Spinal Volt, The Uprising, Locked In. It's just, it's poetic, and the music's phenomenal. So thank you for producing this. It's, you know, we, as fans and lovers of the music, we depend on people like you and Ropadope to make these kind of things possible. And I'm really glad this exists. I'm glad I can listen to it and study it and enjoy it, because I think it's a masterpiece.
I agree. I do want to point out that the production is all self-production, and that we're advocates for the music once it's finished.
Got it. So they brought the finished work to you?
Correct.
Great. Let's when we get to the talking about the label in particular, let's go into that a little more, because that's a really interesting and important model. But before we do that, I want to talk a little about the label's history. The label's been around 18 years?
Yes, since 99.
Since 99. And I think from what I understand, one of the milestones in the history of this label was the label's work in post, we call it Katrina, but we really should, to be accurate, we should call it the post U.S. Army Corps of Engineers levee system failure flood. By the way, I was extremely involved with levees.org. And if you Google my name and levees.org, you'll get some background on that. But we'll just call it Katrina just for the sake of shorthand. But you were very involved in post-Katrina New Orleans, which was a very interesting time indeed for many people. Can you tell us a little about what you were doing there and how you were involved in the rebuilding?
Certainly. And it's an interesting time for me. I'll mention the personal first. So I had been involved with Ropadope in the clothing side of their company for some time. And 2006, summertime, was an interesting moment for the label. They were working on a project with Preservation Hall with Ben Jaffe, which is the re-recording, if you will, or I don't want to call it remix, but the Sister Gertrude Morgan record, and people, if they don't know, can look that up, was something that Alan Jaffe recorded back in the 70s, and Preservation Hall was re-releasing that recording, and then having, you know, with Ropadope, King Britt and Tim Motzer write new music to accompany it, and releasing that record called King Britt Presents Sister Gertrude Morgan. Actually, the release date was scheduled for Tuesday, whatever it is after August 28th. Whatever that Tuesday is. And so, you know, the levees failed in the process of that, the marketing push, which, as you can imagine, kind of changed the perspective and potential immediate success of the album. But at that moment, you know, our eyes were on New Orleans for those reasons. And in the process right after the storm, you know, the question was, you know, what can we do to help musicians? And of course, Ben had set up the New Orleans Musicians Hurricane Relief Fund. And we created a T-shirt, simple, Re-New Orleans, red lettering, red and white lettering, and put those online immediately to raise money. And I think we raised a good $90,000 in a short period of time from selling those T-shirts, which went directly to the fund. And without a lot of administrative overhead, because it was set up on the spot, you know, for that purpose, money was flowing directly to musicians to replace instruments and, you know, and help people return to New Orleans. But an interesting thing happened at that moment. You know, for those that weren't, you know, that focused on it at the time, we kind of forget this in history, but there was a persistent marketing push through, you know, news, press conferences and such, where people in high places were talking about, you know, why doesn't everybody just move to Houston and New Orleans is a disaster and why should we rebuild? And, you know, that drumbeat was pretty heavy. And that was demoralizing. You know, to me, it seemed demoralizing from the outside for people who had left, gone to Nashville, couldn't get back. The Army Corps wasn't letting people back, I think, at some point. And all of the images coming out where this is some crazy lawless community that doesn't deserve to be rebuilt kind of a vibe.
Exactly.
And so, you know, the T-shirt took on a new meaning, you know. It meant we are going to rebuild. And people were wearing the shirts on, you know, that's why one of the reasons they're so popular is not just people from outside New Orleans buying the shirt in order to donate some money. a lot of people in New Orleans were purchasing these shirts, and a lot of people returning were purchasing them. So much so that when the show Tremé was being produced sometime later, we got a phone call and they said, you know, we're trying to recreate the first second line after the storm. And we're looking at photographs, and everyone in these photographs is wearing this Re New Orleans t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
So can we get, you know, 200 shirts so that we can do this scene? And of course we're like, yeah, absolutely. You know, they're $25 a piece, you know, and send some more money down to New Orleans. And they did, you know, to their credit, they did, you know, I've talked to people like Big Sam and others, you know, where, you know, they were extremely supportive of help, you know, having, you know, true New Orleans musicians in that show.
Yeah.
For paid opportunities. But, you know, the larger point is that, you know, it really became an emotional point and a point of hope, I think, for a lot of people through a simple t-shirt, you know.
We're on the phone, so we can't see each other. Please go ahead.
You know, it also meant for Rope-A-Dope that changes had to be made at that time, and that is when I invested in and took over at the label, because – you know, the expectations a lot of time in the business are, you know, this next record's going to make everything work, you know, all in the middle of a persistent decline in sales in the record business. But, you know, that kind of signaled a major change in Rope-A-Dope at that point. So, you know, it's funny. It continues to come back to me as a starting point and a reinvigoration of the label as well as the city, you know, they're sort of synced up.
And I think, you know, your account is 100% accurate. There was a strong, persistent, widespread campaign through the media to basically advocate the bulldozing of New Orleans, or at least large parts of it, and, you know, turn it into a golf course, turn it into this, turn it into that. And it was very demoralizing. And as a little sideline for you and people that may not be aware, believe it or not, at levees.org, we traced some of the origin of that campaign to computers owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Why?
This is taking us completely off track, but it's an opportunity to share this. There was an employee at the New Orleans office posing, you know, the old, it's called sock puppet. You pretend to be a Joe Average going all over on all these bulletin boards all over the world and basically disparaging New Orleans and New Orleanians and everything. And
this is pre-Russian bots. Yeah.
Yeah. No Russian bots needed. And it's a long story, but that's how bad it was. And, you know, even as late as 2010, there was no, you know, that's 5 years into it. There was no sense that the city was ever going to really get back on its feet. Now it's doing pretty well, but it was a strong, long struggle, and morale was everything. And my friend John Swenson wrote a beautiful book called New Atlantis, How Jazz Musicians Brought New Orleans Back to Life. And it's a story that those of us who love music and culture and jazz in particular really should just tell over and over again, because we really was people from the music world, musicians, producers, t-shirt makers. And those t-shirts were really important. I remember seeing them. I remember I didn't have one of those, but I had a bunch of similar t-shirts that had positive statements, and that meant a lot. There were a lot of signs that people would put up in front of their houses, in front of their stores, and it was an extremely, extremely important thing. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, had there not been that cumulative effort from so many people, including Rope-A-Dope, had that not occurred, they might have bulldozed the Lower Nine. They might have bulldozed whole sections of the city and turned them into golf courses, because that was the intention among certain people. So it was a big deal, and we should celebrate it. We should celebrate the resistance. Hey, let's talk about – well, you brought in something that sort of caught my ear. So you entered the business on the apparel side.
Correct.
Tell me a little about that apparel. It makes a lot of sense. In fact, I was talking – speaking of New Orleans, I was talking with this great New Orleans alto player – Donald Harris.
Donald Harrison.
Yeah. Donald Harris. And he's
Harrison. Christian's uncle.
He is. Oh. Of course. Yeah. And he's also an Indian chief, a Mardi Gras Indian chief.
Correct.
And we were actually talking in real time, in real space, a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the importance of integrating music with clothing, with style, with food, with lifestyle. You know, not not having the music sort of sitting off by itself, pristine and unconnected with the rest of daily life. And so tell me about this fusion of apparel and music. It's very fascinating to me now.
Well, interesting. The answer is not as exotic. I was in the clothing business, and you know, as we rounded 2001, you know, and iTunes opened, artists were frantically looking for ways to, you know, increase revenue as CD sales were declining, and clothing was one of those things. And there's some pioneers who got the sense of it from what, you know, Mr. Harrison is saying, people like DJ Shadow, Rope-A-Dope, OK Player in the Roots, and we were producing, you know, merchandise for them and operating, setting up e-commerce stores, you know, which seems like an everyday thing right now, but back then it was brand new for a lot of musicians, you know, Preservation Hall, Duck Down Records, Def Jux Records, you know, everybody kind of came to us, or a lot of people came to us to do that work. And Rope-A-Dope, of course, was building a branded clothing line as part of their marketing and lifestyle. Fashion is interesting. I mean, it's, you know, there are some very personal decisions people make about their lives, and one of them is how they look, and the other, you know, the other is what kind of music they like, you know. And I do think they go hand in hand. So that's the business that I was involved in, and that's how I became connected with so many musicians.
Oh, I see. I can tell you an interesting story about e-commerce. I was really active in internet commercialization, which really sounds like an arcane subject, but believe it or not, it was a huge topic in 93 and 94. And I had a colleague, he acquired a German company, East German company, believe it or not, or run by East Germans, and it was a e-commerce platform. And this was like early 95, and it only cost $25,000, and it only took a month to configure it. The software.
Wow.
And yeah, we've come a long way since then. And
I can do that in 2 hours now.
Right. But you needed and you needed a degree in electrical engineering to get this thing to even work. But the years that you're talking about, you're saying like 1999 or what?
It wasn't simple as there were no plug and play services. You had to build your store.
Definitely not.
Yeah, had to figure out your credit card processing and shipping integration, and of course, you know, how to market it. I think that most people came to us because we were doing something different than souvenir merchandise, you know, buy a band t-shirt with tour dates on it, but that we were helping people, you know, build brands through apparel.
My understanding that t-shirts, you know, the simplest level of this, became an important part of the rock, you know, and roll business from, you know, pretty early on. It was recognized right away that, gee, you could make a lot of money. In fact, I think it started out with hippies sort of selling t-shirts at concerts, and then slowly promoters started to realize that the hippies selling the t-shirts outside of the concerts were sometimes making as much as the concert promoter.
There it is. The Grateful Dead model. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. So cool. So clothing and apparel and fashion is part of the Rope-A-Dope world. And now we're in 2018 when this interview is being recorded. Can you give us a picture of the shape of Rope-A-Dope? Now, you mentioned that the Wisdom album that we started talking about by Eddie Palmieri, they produced it, and your role is to bring it to the world. Tell us more about that model.
Yeah, I mean, the Rope-A-Dope model, something that I redesigned and developed in response to what was happening in the business, and also in response to what my particular sentiments are. I'm building a company that represents the way I would like the music business to be, and responding to what's out there. You know, creative control, creativity in general, in my opinion, should be fully in the hands of the artists, and that a label or business should simply support them in that process. And in addition, you know, part of that foundation is that each individual artist is basically an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
In order to have creative control, you need to run your own business, and you need to connect with your own fans. And there are many examples of bands that have done this in the past. Grateful Dead is a great example, but, you know, by accident, because no one else really wanted to deal with them. They just built their own business. But that's the foundation of what we do, is that mission statement of we want to support independent artists as business people and also as creatives. And then, you know, what are the suite of tools that we put together, given the resources we have, in order to help them do that? So our model is really about just being a support agency. We do many of the things that a regular label does, but, you know, at its core, we look at what an artist needs and we find out a way to do that with the least expense and most impact. And we try to use as many of the new tools as possible. The internet is fantastic, and I know you have a history in helping make that happen. You know, people can connect with each other worldwide. You can bring things to market much more quickly, and you can literally talk to your fans and build a community. So, you know, that's certainly a tool that we're using. Social media, you know, in the years from 2010 to 2015 or 16, I would say, was extremely powerful as a form of free advertising and connection with fans. It's changing a bit now. You know, there's a full suite of tools. You mentioned building websites, how much easier that's got. So, you know, we're taking usually finished albums from independent artists and then adding as many tools as possible and being responsive to the artist for what their particular needs are in order to help them build a fan base, build connection. And hopefully, and our goal is at the end of, you know, if there is an end, or at any point year after year when we're reviewing it, that a person has a little bit more strength, power, and connection in their own independent business, rather than making a record, marketing it, and then coming back to the well for, you know, to a record label again because they have to.
Wow,
hopefully that
makes
sense.
It makes perfect sense, because it's something that's been on my mind since the beginning. You know, but let's, you know, to help people really appreciate this, the old model was you sign on with the label. Typically, you're naive, you don't know what you're doing, and you give away too much. You basically sign away your freedom, creative freedom, for a period of time, which might turn out to be a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You commit yourself to a certain level of production, whether you're ready or not, or, you know, and the label may or may not decide to support you after all that. You know, they may sign you up, lock you up for a couple, or, you know, for 5 years or more, and then decide there's not much can be done with you and you're languishing. And it put musicians, you know, people talk about the golden age of recording, and I don't, you know, there were certain good things, like if you hit it big and the label was behind you, you know, amazing things could happen. But if you look at the actual experience, I think, of the majority of musicians under that system, it was not a great system, in my opinion. It was not a golden age. And I think what you're describing, you know, is not a golden age, because, look, it's reality. We live in the real world. There are no golden ages. There's just work and getting things done. But the model that you're proposing, this is what's profound about it, is you're putting the artists in the driver's seat. You know, they tell you what they want to produce. You're not really involved in that. They just come to you with their best stuff. For instance, the Wisdom album from Eddie Palmieri. I knew there was something different about that album when I heard it. Now I understand why. Mm-hmm. It's their vision. And then you are connecting them with you're helping them connect and broaden their connection with their audience. And this is something that old labels absolutely did not do. They wanted to control everything. And the ideal scenario was just as you described, the musician goes out, makes an album, tours, money is made, and then to keep the wheels turning, they have to come back and start from basically zero, entirely dependent on the label. And that's just – that cannot be a good model for the majority of humanity, in my opinion. And it's much better. It's so much better for the artist to end up with his – to me, it always boils down to list. Now, whether it's an email list or a Facebook following or a combination of all those things, the currency of any business, and that includes the music business, and that includes being a musician, is having a list of fans.
Yep.
Because if you have a list of fans that's big enough, you can just announce, hey, we're going to do a new album. Prepay, or, you know, if you wanted to go that way, and you're funded and you've already got your buzz going. But anyway, I pontificate. But
no, I want to comment on that, if you don't mind.
Yep.
You know, it really comes down to, you know, the larger piece of what's shifting in society, and that is, you know, the old model, and I don't know if it's the old model, but it's certainly the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, is we have the customers. Can you make us something that we can deliver to them? And that's, and so we're shifting that whole thing to we love what you make. Please be as creative as possible. And then we'll go out and try to find people who enjoy this. And sometimes if they don't, we'll help teach them. Similar in many ways to like a microbrew or craft mm-hmm. movement, you know, find the quality and then teach people why it's quality and how to enjoy it.
Gotcha. And then meanwhile, the artist is accumulating an audience that he or she has connection with.
Absolutely.
As opposed to having to go through this middleman. And yeah, the old model was, hey, we've got a lot of records, we have a lot of distribution, and we need to keep the racks full, and we need something in country and western rack.
Yep.
Make something for us, and we'll put it in there, and you know, good luck to you. Yeah. So this is really good. So how would people, let's say somebody's out there and they feel they have something developed and worthwhile, and they like this idea of collaborating with a label as opposed to, you know, becoming a vassal of a label, which is really what it was like, right? I mean, let's face it, musicians
I've
were
heard
treated
some stories.
Like,
yeah,
they were really treated like serfs under the old model, and for a certain
many still
tiny
are.
Percent, for a certain tiny percentage, it might have worked out spectacularly. But I think if you look at the vast scale, not so spectacular. So you also say you also are involved in teaching them, helping them visualize how to build their brand. And to me, a brand is just, you know, your following, the people that know you and understand you and you can contact and be in touch with, and who can contact and be in touch with you. What form does that take, the teaching? Is it informal? Do you have formal training?
It's both. You know, it's a collaborative community-based thing. So there are informal things right from the start when I speak to an artist about signing with the label, rather than saying, you know, here, you know, I'll take you out to dinner. We sit down and we put together a spreadsheet of what, you know, what this marketing spend means for sales and how many records we need to sell. So we're starting right in with a sort of a Excel spreadsheet financial projection discussion. I'm sharing information that I have about how the business works and feeding back to an artist, you know, this is what happens if you have an electronic record that was made in your studio and you're not going to go out and tour. Mm-hmm. What to expect. Here are some resources on helping you manage your own tours. Here are some leads. Here are all the venues in the country. Here are the festivals that you should apply to. This is a timeline that you should stick to. Those kinds of things. And then it opens up into collaborative. So it goes to staff next. So the staff is completely available to answer questions for artists on a regular basis. And then it moves to community level, where we have a private channel for artists to communicate with each other so that they can share their successes or failures with other artists on the label. You know, pretty much an open source kind of discussion. Part of the obstacle, you know, one of the obstacles we face is mentality. It's getting better every year. But when we first started doing this, you know, people were like, people were conditioned, especially the trumpet players, that, you know, somebody can take your gig, you know, that you're supposed to be in competition with other artists, you know, and it's a really silly presumption at the end, because people listen to more than one artist. I know on a given gig, you could get swapped out, but in general, you know, there's enough interest in music out there for everybody to share. So, you know, why not share information with each other?
Sure.
It's ironic that the music business was the first to be disrupted by technology, but it's last in line with open source models and collaborative work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because 60% of the supply in the market is controlled by three companies. And of course, 80-some percent of the distribution at retail is controlled by three companies. It's a battle to kind of open that up, but that's what we do. So,
wow.
Coaching and guidance, and then community involvement.
Wow. Wow, this is great. This is great. I knew there was a reason I wanted to interview you. I guess I intuited some of it from just looking at some of the material on your website, but this really fills it out for me. This is the 21st century approach to being a label, in my opinion, and I'm really glad to hear that about this work. Hey, you've got a bunch of, I guess, for lack of a better word, sub-labels. Can you talk a little bit about those? For instance, one that really fascinates me is Ropadope Sir, which I guess fronted by a guy who's based in Mexico City.
Yes, Todd Clouser. So the impetus for the imprints, obviously sub-label denotes some inferiority, which we don't want to use.
Sorry,
so
we say
imprint. Yep. Yeah. No, imprint. I go through that every time, you know. So, you know, as part of the quote vision, the idea was, you know, well, who's best for A&R? Who knows the music the best? Well, clearly the artists do, right? So let's put the artists in charge of A&R. And there are certain people who have their networks and, you know, who have friends and collaborators who are making great records. So let's let them choose. And of course, you know, there is the overall brand impression of what Ropadope is. And so if we've got a reggae album coming our way, we might ordinarily say no. But if we have a person who's central to reggae, or in Todd Clouser's case, who's central to Mexico and South and Central America, he's in a great position to put music together out on an imprint that, you know, makes sense, right, from a branding perspective. So, you know, Todd is one of probably 11 or 12 imprints now. But Todd, you know, there are distinctions between these imprints. Some are just vanity labels for an artist to put out their own projects. Some are the vanity label plus, where it's their own projects and some of their network. And some are more deliberate branding or regional initiatives. If you say, like, mm-hmm. Atlanta Records is a collaboration between myself and Brian Hurst at soulandjazz.com, because he is very much in touch with a certain crossover type of where soul, jazz, and R&B meet. So that focuses on that. And in Todd's case, you know, Todd and I have always talked about, you know, what the business should be and what the initiative is. And he's a really, really unique individual, you know, a nomadic ambassador for music. And also music as it gets to the root of the social and cultural identities mm-hmm, of people. Mm-hmm. So he's brought some really interesting things to play. He does a show, a radio show called Radio 21 Million in conjunction with soulandjazz.com, interestingly enough. And he has put out records from ranchers in Mexico, Los Carnicheros de Sepiariz, pardon my Spanish again. You know, people that he's met and felt that he, you know, can offer something to, who are making music in, you know, even remote places that wouldn't ordinarily get to the rest of the world. So that one bears the name Ropadope for that obvious reason, that it's a little closer in.
I just want to, if I may comment on that, people who had a chance to get around a little bit and get off the beaten track, one of the things that you'll discover is there's a lot of music out there that's really good that we don't even have a whiff of.
Yeah.
And the idea of, I guess that particularly caught my imagination, the idea of somebody looking for that and helping that music find its way into the marketplace, the music marketplace, is very exciting. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a really great, great initiative. Well, let's talk about the consumer side. So first of all, your website. So if somebody wants to know more about the offerings that Ropadope is helping bring to market, where do they go? I mean, you have obviously the website. It's ropadope.com, or?
Yeah. So yeah, starting point for anything that's happening, for news of what's coming up and releases that are rolling out through the year, ropadope.com is the starting point. The front page will tell you who's, you know, which of the 70 releases that are scheduled are hitting this week or upcoming. You can learn about new music. There's more in-depth artist pages to learn more about each artist at that site. And there's also a store that carries some of the Ropadope branded clothing. But a key spot is the Bandcamp pages. So Bandcamp is, for those that aren't familiar, you know, is a way to buy direct from an artist and also curate your own collection of music that other people can see and share and learn from, and vice versa. So downloads.ropadope.com, just inappropriate title at this point, URL at this point. Basically, we'll have all albums that are coming up, including pre-orders, with the ability to stream for free, but also be able to buy directly in CD, vinyl, or direct download. And that's the absolute best place for artists, because that's where you're connecting directly with an artist, right? So, you know, they can send you new information. And then, you know, if you do buy a record on there, the next time that person releases a record, you get a pretty innocuous email that says, hey, just wanted to give you a heads up. There's a new record coming out from Christian Scott or whomever. And then, you know, unfortunately, technologically right now, all of the labels can't be in one place. So you do have to kind of refer back to the label page on ropeitup.com for, you know, all of these different imprints. And then, you know, we're out in all the other places. If people are Spotify listeners, Rope It Up has a channel where we do some playlists, and, you know, most of the artists can be found there. And of course, on Apple Music, not only is everything available there, but I also curate a playlist on Apple Music where I mix Rope It Up music with other things that interest me. A lot of that is topical, but it's tends to put what we do and what our artists are doing in historical context. At least that's what I'm trying to do.
Uh-huh.
So if you search Rope It Up on Apple Music, you'll find a curator there, and that's coming directly from me. There'll also be an ongoing playlist of upcoming releases. So rather than reading it, you can just, you know, click on that playlist and it'll just play everything that's coming out soon.
Great. Great. Wow. So yeah, you're user friendly. I know it's an endless challenge, you know, but I'm particularly in, oh wow, I see a friend of mine, Uncle Nephew. I know this guy. That was
Darren
one of your
Powell
brothers,
Darren Hoffman. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Darren just got a gig in Florida as a faculty member at the big music school there. I think it's University of Florida. Anyway, but
nice.
Wow, that's awesome. Also, that's well, this is a class. We actually interviewed him because we were huge supporters of Tradition is a Temple when that was in pre-production, and he helped us. We did a benefit. We were participating in a benefit at Le Poisson Rouge, the old village gate for Puerto Rico,
uh-huh.
And it was a ridiculous star-studded event. I mean, we had, of course, I'm going to draw blanks on everybody's name. Randy Brecker was there. Paquita de Rivera was there. John Faddis was playing. I mean, just
nice.
it was a recreation of this amazing milieu that took place in this New York in the 70s and 80s every Monday night at the Village Gate. Straight-ahead jazz musicians and Latin musicians would meet every Monday and jam. And it was a great, great thing. And so this was a recreation of that. And anyway, long story short, I asked the producer of it, Bobby Sanabria, hey, who's going to film it? Because this is amazing. And he said, oh, we couldn't, you know, they threw it together very fast, so there was no chance. So I called up my friend and I said, look, you're a filmmaker. Let's film it. So as a result, we have a film of that evening. So anyway, I took myself off track. But yeah, everybody, I want to just encourage you to go to Rope-A-Dope. One of the things you might want to check out are the different labels, you know, because you probably have a kind of music that you like, or maybe you're exploratory and want to see all the different labels they have and see what those labels are doing. And I'm really intrigued with your show on Apple Music. You may be the person that gets me to sign up for Apple Music because I haven't done that yet.
They would be very happy about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is
Apple,
part of it. I mean, Apple's a strong supporter, you know, in a lot of ways. I mean, we can complain about things, you know, sort of in the hands of a few. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that the companies that are Apple and Spotify are both, you know, much more democratic and supportive than, you know, a company was in, say, the 80s or 90s of diversity, you know. They're kind of like a new radio format. So
we know, interestingly enough, talking about the internet industry and the arc of history, literally yesterday I was listening to an industry analyst and he said, look, you know, Google and Amazon and all these companies are starting slowly. It's starting slowly to dawn on them that, yes, it's been a successful business model to cannibalize content. Or not cannibalize, but, well, I guess, I forget the word he used, appropriate, or I don't know the exact word he used. But basically what they're doing is taking other people's content, repackaging it, and putting ads on it.
Right.
And he said, yeah, that's a great model until you kill all the content producers and you have no content to repackage. And he said
right.
that at the higher levels of those companies, they're starting to dawn on them that they really need to take some of those billions and billions of dollars that they've made and be supportive in ways they can with content producers. Otherwise, they're not going to have anything to repackage. So, yep. You know, we're in this long arc of history, and it may end up that these big companies more and more appreciate the efforts. It sounds like Apple's already understanding the value of Rope-A-Dope. You got a channel on Apple Music, which is I hear it's a great thing. Can you, not that this is an ad for Apple Music, but what can you tell people what makes Apple Music unique? I mean, I knew the theory of it when it got started. Can you talk a little about what kind of opportunity they offer you as a DJ?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, first of all, Apple has iTunes was the dominant force for a long time. But comparing the streaming services, really, you know, it's kind of a niche thing. There are two different types of streaming services, right? Apple, you know, prides itself on the curator aspect of, you know, having a good presentation, a good look that's easy to navigate, and to have, you know, some of the real things up front so that, you know, you don't have to dig through a pile of homemade content, if you will, in order to get to something interesting. And I don't think that they, you know, certainly in hip hop, they're probably focusing on the top five, you know, because that's the main game. But in jazz and others, you know, you can find all kinds of things in there. I don't really play their algorithm. And I think that might be interesting to some people. And that really, it kind of comes down to that, is if you just want to press play on an algorithm and let it roll and see what pops up. That's interesting sometimes to find new music. But then a lot of the body can get off track because the computer's doing it. So Apple's kind of, you know, presenting back to you things that are similar that might be, that are more targeted and of better interest. And I think there's people involved in that. I like the program because I can, you know, just pop anything. I like to ramble, if it hasn't been evident already, and connect things that wouldn't ordinarily be connected. So, and I pop onto Apple Music and I'm playing and making a playlist. I can just, you know, be like, yeah, you know, so here's this Christian Scott song, and that kind of reminds me, for some reason, of Johnny Cash, you know, and then I could just pop Johnny Cash in right next to it, you know. And I think that if people are listening to my playlist, what I'm trying to do is the opposite of what a DJ is normally trying to do, something that makes sense and flows, but have something that changes pretty frequently, has a good context and reason for being there, but it's not because I listened to the last three seconds and merged it into the next song, or that I went with some sort of genre algorithm. In my estimation, these days are days where anything can get drowned out in the background. And so change up is good. So that'll be my pitch for my playlist, is that you don't know what you're going to hear. And drift away, I might pull you back with some jarring change in genre.
Well, in the hands of an informed person, yeah, that's a great model. You know, if an informed person like you, I want you to surprise me. I want you to make connections that I wouldn't otherwise make. And I think that was the point of when James – I never knew how to pronounce his name. I think it's Iovine?
Jimmy Iovine.
Yeah. And he made this point because he's involved with it very much. I don't know if he's running it or he certainly contributed to the idea. He said, look, you know, it took a year for Bruce Springsteen to figure out the sequence of songs on Born to Run, you know, which one to put first, which one to put second. And that was a human decision. That was not, and it was an artistic decision. It was not, you know, the computer programs are wonderful and, you know, they're interesting and, you know, nothing bad about them really. But nothing beats an informed human being that's into music, who's really listening and really thinking, deciding what to play next. And that was his point. He says the big issue in music is what's next. Not, and he didn't mean what's, you know, what's the next fad, but literally what's the next tune. And that is really an art, coming up with what are you going to play after what's playing now, and where is it going to lead somebody. So if people go to Apple Music and they search Rope-A-Dope, they can find your channel. Well, this is great. I want to thank you so much, Louis. We're coming up to our hour, and you've been very generous with your time and your thoughts. And it's exciting that you exist and Rope-A-Dope exists. This is, I think, 21st century music label. And it's the early years of this way of doing things, but I think you guys are pioneers in this, and it's a great service to the artists, and it's a great service to people who love music. So everybody check out ropeadope.com, and definitely you just got to get this Wisdom album by Eddie Palmieri. It's a no-brainer. Just get it. If you don't like it, I'll buy it back from you, and I'll give it to a friend of mine as a gift. That's how confident I am that this is an amazing album. This is the kind of thing you can listen to 100 times. And the 100th time, you're like, wow, I can't believe how good this is.
Yeah.
And it is an education in music, just listening, because he takes it everywhere on this thing. So, Louis, thanks a lot. Keep in touch. I guess I'll sign up for some kind of newsletter, I hope, with you, so that I'll get constant news about Ropeadope. Do you have such a thing, like an email letter?
Yes, it's right at the bottom of the website. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. I'm going to sign up for that.
It's a pretty infrequent. You know, it's like an every 2 to 3 months kind of thing. We don't overwhelm people, but it's there.
Okay, cool.
Ken,
well,
I
want to
say thank you so much. I really, really appreciate what you do and the opportunity to talk with you. The
pleasure's all mine. Thanks. And I'll see you around the internet.
You got it. Be well.
Bye. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.